All right. Well, I've just found out that there is, in fact, no internet connection, so I am going to have to describe the videos to you, but we can, you know, we learn to make do. Anyway, my name's Roberta Newman, and the name of my presentation is We Love Baseball, Hot Dogs, Apple Pie, Chevrolet, and Cat Food, and Margarine, and Baseball Advertising in the Age of Mad Men. All right, so as fans of Mad Men know, the late 1960s, 50s through the 60s represented a period of unprecedented growth and creativity in the advertising agency. New, even revolutionary advertising techniques marked the best of what was produced, so much so that the era's been dubbed the Creative Revolution. Central to the work of the period was a shift away from selling products to what we now recognize as selling images. Even as the 60s receded, techniques pioneered during the Creative Revolution continued to have a lasting effect on advertising. As the decade turned and shifted away from the idealism of the 1960s, new creative advertising methods were used to different ends, reflecting the zeitgeist of the me generation into the early 80s. At the same time, baseball entered a new era of free agency, the designated hitter of George Steinbrenner, its own me generation. Once again, it was there to furnish Mad Men with the appropriate images for appropriate times. George Lois, founder of Papert, Koenig, and Lois, one of Madison Avenue's first boutique agencies, was a madman who clearly understood how to tap baseball to create potent advertising images. The hallmark of Lois's work was offbeat humor. We now associate humor with successful advertising. Look at how an animated gecko managed to, sounding like Michael Caine, and a creatively quacking duck has managed to rebrand insurance as something cool, right? I'm not even gonna talk about those cavemen. That was a real advertising fail, okay? But before the 1950s, this wasn't the case. Now, among George Lois's earliest work is this 1955 print ad. 1955, keep this in mind, for American Airlines. Appearing 2 years before the Dodgers' defection. I'm from Brooklyn, so where I'm from, we tend to call it defection. On this side of the country, not so much. Okay. Although I'm sure there's no fondness right here for, you wish they stayed in Brooklyn, yeah. Okay, so appearing 2 years before that, it plays on the persistent rumors that Brooklyn's pride and joy were planning to follow Horace Greeley's admonition to go west and grow up with the country. Using wit and a degree of honesty, all with the goal of personalizing newly affordable coast-to-coast direct air travel, a service that, however ironically, made the relocation of major league teams to California practical. Not only does the ad not say anything about air travel, note it, rather the ad brands its product via irreverent humor that makes potential customers feel like they are in the know. By the way, the Dodgers declined to participate in this ad. Oh, I wonder why, right? And that's Lois himself wearing the Dodgers cap because he couldn't get anyone to model for it. Okay. Lois and his peers also utilized techniques that also leaned heavily on gentleness, credibility, and a willingness to treat consumers as perceived equals. This new direction ran counter to the traditional advertising wisdom that still dominated the mainstream, which relied on approaches like the unique selling proposition, which eschewed artistic and interesting copy in favor of a single clear message that the competition ostensibly could not make. Take, for example, Colgate toothpaste with its Guardol shield, the magic ingredient capable of stopping bad breath as effectively as its sheet of plexiglass can stop a baseball. It says, you have bad breath, we have Guardol, we have the solution. No humor, no anything, it is what it is. Okay, new advertising techniques called for a new type of product endorser, and George Lewis knew, knew just the celebrity. Perhaps no baseball player more carefully and closely embodied the new advertising spirit than Yogi Berra. Okay, now, I wish I could show you this ad. In this ad, Yogi Berra has a long, interesting conversation with this cat about what makes the cat, who's been jumping on a trampoline and running an obstacle course, etc., about what makes him such a great athlete. The cat, in the first ad that ever featured a talking live animal. There had been some with animated animals, never with a live animal before. You don't see its face, though. There's no CGI. It answers him in a heavy Long Island accent, provided by Whitey Ford. I mean, you can't make this up. I wish I could show you. He credited it all to hard work and working out and Puss in Boots, cat food. Okay? Notes Lois, the charming juxtaposition of the bearish Yogi Berra in a dialogue with a pussycat was a visual tour de force as the cat's verbal wisdom convinced viewers that a real discussion was taking place. Also adding, oh, I already told you that. Oddly, given the success of the Finnish commercial, Quaker Oats, Puss in Boots' former parent company, was not initially entranced with the concept of having a baseball player pitch this particular product. After all, women, it figured, produced most of the country's cat food. Would they even recognize Yogi Berra? Lois conducted some market research. He surveyed 200 women. Of them, 182 could readily identify Yogi Berra. So how does the spot work? Berra's praise for Puss in Boots' fantastic effects on his co-star's conditioning transfers to the product. Imbuing cat food with his perceived humor, goodness, and down-to-earth wisdom, not to mention real athletic talent and good health. This spot's particularly important as I noticed that it was the first also to feature a celebrity, a baseball player of other or otherwise, as an actor in a mini film rather than as a straightforward pitch man holding up a product saying, use this. Now, we're really used to that, but this was really a groundbreaking commercial. Okay, and it set a precedent for endorsement advertising to come. Yogi Berra was the perfect player for the baseball player for the creative revolution. He was, in fact, baseball's answer to the Volkswagen Beetle, popularized by Doyle Dane Burnback's. Doyle Dane Burnback's. Groundbreaking Think Small ad campaign, one of the hallmarks of the creative revolution. Of it, the graphic designer Joshua Johnson asks, how did a funny-looking little car that was named after a bug, known for being slow and manufactured in factories built by Nazis, ever become iconic to a generation of post-war Americans? Great design and fantastic marketing. Now, I'm not sure if you can read it, and I'm going to connect this to baseball. Don't worry, we're going back there. But it says the copy, like the image, runs counter to conventional automobile advertising. What appealed to the new segment of post-war car buyers, including the nascent counterculture, was the ad's honesty, Never before had an automobile ad called its product a strange little car. Okay? Berra was his own way, in his own way, very much like the ad's Volkswagen. In comparison to the era's baseball gods, he was small and fairly strange looking for an elite athlete. Okay? Yet, like the Beatle, he could play all day and do it well. Above all, he seemed to be innately sensible, even when conversing with a talking cat that sounded just like Whitey Ford. In contrast, Mickey Mantle, baseball's golden boy, was no Volkswagen Beetle. There we go. Neither was he a stranger to endorsement advertising. But his ability not to take himself too seriously off the diamond allowed him to make a transition to this new form. Take, for example, his Maple commercial. In it, he appears, bat perched on his shoulder, shedding tears and whines, "I want my Mapo." His plea, followed by others, Will Chamberlain, Don Meredith, Johnny Unitas, Oscar Robertson, and Ray Nitschke. You know, guys in all those other sports, right? We won't talk about those. In imitation of Mapo's animated advertising icon, Marky Mapo, the delightful tyke who whined the company's slogan in support of maple-flavored oatmeal from televisions across America. Okay. Another George Lois production. I think he did everything in the 1960s. The new Mapo spot was not a testimonial as hard sell, but rather testimonial as parody. Once again, we've become accustomed to parody ads. Take Troy Polamalu's reenactment of the classic Mean Joe Green Coke commercial. Or David Ortiz posing as a bachata singer in support of Dunkin' Iced Coffee. But this too was new. Not only did the pre-creative revolution advertising lack a sense of humor, about its product and the process, it really lacked a sense of humor about itself. But I Want My Mapo changed that. So arresting and self-mocking and, yes, annoying was this ad. And trust me, annoyance sells. Who can forget Whisk, No More Ring Around the Collar? That's one of the most successful ads of all time. I'm sorry I gave you these earworms. Just wait, there's a better one coming. Although creative advertising became more commonplace by the end of the 60s, it did not replace conventional techniques. Advertisers continued to utilize humor and self-parody to sell a new batch of consumers with new concerns, but other people did other things. After his career ended, Mickey Mantle continued to be tapped as an endorser. In one of the oddest athlete endorsements of the time, though not the oddest, I believe that one goes to Joe Namath in pantyhose. Why do I keep having trouble with this? Okay. I wish I could show you this. I really, really, really wish I could show you this. No, that's not actually Mickey Mantle. But we'll get to that. He appeared with Willie Mays, Jamie Farr of MASH, and Georgia Engel of the Mary Tyler Moore Show in a commercial selling Blue Bonnet margarine. Okay, and in this ad, first Engel in costume as her character Georgette, who's ultimately, like, totally the characteristic scatterbrained blonde who can't remember whether she actually loves Blue Bonnet, but then decides she really does, is followed up by Jamie Farr in full clinger drag, complete with the cigar and hairy arms, talking about how he loves Blue Bonnet. The last piece of it, I kid you not, if anybody's ever seen this, Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle sitting side by side in poke bonnets, in prairie bonnets, eating a big plate of food and each holding giant corn cobs, sang the Blue Bonnet jingle, "Everything's better with Blue Bonnet on it." Please excuse my singing. Okay, so why them? They targeted a new demographic for food products. In a cultural shift that found increasing numbers of men both in the supermarket and the kitchen, both the result of the soaring divorce rate and the tendency of couples to share household chores. Anyway, as more women joined the workforce, grocery advertisers set their sights on male shoppers. Men are less imaginative, giving them themselves less to a commercial, notes Bernard Owett, who is an executive of J. Walter Thompson. Women, according to Owett, are easier to manipulate with fantasy and romance. Thanks, Owett. In order to capture the new male market, advertisers tried different strategies. Various manufacturers relied upon more explicit names for their products, like Hungry Man Frozen Dinner and Manhandler Soups. Writes Miller, "Blue Bonnet Margarine resorts to outright silliness, putting frilly women's bonnets on the heads of Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays. The oddness of men wearing bonnets makes the ads more memorable." Okay, the image of Mantle and Mays, two exemplars of American masculinity in bonnets, is more than odd and memorable. Contrast their image with their co-stars, right? What makes Klinger funny is the very connection between Farr's masculine hairiness and his love of cigars and, of course, the Toledo Mud Hens. Okay, and scatterbrained Georgette. But Mantle and Mays appear as themselves, these great baseball men whose liveliness once depended upon displays of athleticism are divested of their masculine qualities. Only the fact that they're depicted enjoying their margarine with big ears of corn undercuts the ad's emasculating effects, however slightly. On the surface, the ad seems to suggest that if Mantle and Mays are so excited about Blue Bonnet that they can sacrifice their masculinity for it, consumers ought to be excited too. But the subtext is different. It implies that men's new domestic roles are in fact emasculating, reducing them to wearing bonnets and singing the praise of imitation butter, where once they were warriors like their favorite baseball idols. Okay, the 70s were also a time of change for baseball. Bracketed by Doc Ellis's LSD-fueled no-hitter and Mike Vec's ill-conceived disco demolition promotion, so the rise of the NFL, challenging baseball's supremacy as the sport of choice, and of course there was the designated hitter, free agency, George Steinbrenner, etc. The U.S. auto industry was also in a state of upheaval, fueled by the energy crisis and the refusal of the big three automakers to explore new gas-efficient technologies. These factors, combined with the availability of new fuel-efficient imports, like the VW Beetle, the Yogi Berra of cars, spelled potential disaster for this mainstay of the American economy. Okay, so they were also faced with a crisis in consumer confidence in the aftermath of Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed. Still, U.S. automobile manufacturers held on to the traditional idea of Americana, if not in reality, but by their fingernails. This stubborn, inherent conservatism is reflected in General Motors, baseball hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. We could probably all sing the jingle. I don't know if we should or not. No. Okay. Kristen Silver Gruce notes that the ad, especially the jingle, serves as an attempt to define a very different America. She writes, "Foodways, cultural practices, and even consumer products are readily made to symbolize the nation's essence. Such metonyms gesture in term at more abstract notions. The ad seems to say that by driving America, by driving Chevrolet, consumers drive America. Okay? At the same time, it says, we're counterculture too. Look at our jingle singer, Ed Lubunsky, that hippie, out in a field with a piano, practically teaching the world to sing like a Coke ad. While the campaign was effective from the point of view of its longstanding place in America's memory channel, like we can all sing it, right, it doesn't seem to have had a positive impact on Chevy sales. That the creative revolution had a lasting effect on baseball advertising continues to be clear. It brought us Chick's Bring the Long Ball, JetBlue's Big Poppy Pinata ad, and a host of others. We've become accustomed to humor in advertising and branding, the selling of images instead of products as part of our everyday language. No ad pulls it together, like the still relevant Love Affair, which is a remake of baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet, where we love rally monkeys. Rally monkeys are the only ones I can remember. The designated hitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I'm sorry the video didn't work. I hope my explanations worked. Thank you. Questions? Questions? Anybody? Yes? Yeah. Yes, you know, not as much as you would expect, but I can tell you, even though it was a few years ago, it was 2006, that Rafael Palmeiro made $2 million for his Viagra endorsement. So, and the top endorsement earners in baseball are nowhere near as high as the endorsement earners in other sports. Right now, Bryce Harper, I think, is the highest earner in terms of endorsements, but it's just a fraction of his salary.
When I was growing up, my basic memory is all the baseball players that endorse cigarettes, especially at the magazine level. How problematic was that for baseball? Do they care one way or the other?
Not at all. Baseball players smoked. They smoked in the dugout. It really, you know, it's funny, if you look all the way back, Ty Cobb was virulently anti-smoking, and he actually wrote articles for a variety of magazines saying that it wasn't good for athletes, but he seemed to be a total minority. The only thing that advertisers and baseball got really upset about was when athletes endorsed a brand of cigarettes they didn't smoke if they smoked another brand, because that interfered with truth in advertising. Then you also had athletes like Jackie Robinson, who did Old Gold endorsements and Chesterfield endorsements. Here's the thing, he didn't smoke, but nobody really seemed to care. Yeah. You know what? Very few. They were, but only after they crossed the color line. The only minority athlete, the only athletes of color that you found endorsing products were in the black press, and they were local. You started to see national ads by athletes of color in magazines like Ebony and Jet. But it wasn't until Willie Mays that the color line was breached. And later, Jackie Robinson became a major figure. But it was very slow, much slower than the desegregation of the major leagues.
One of the first ones I remember was Bob Gibson, who tried to team this, the asthma commercial. That's the one that sticks in my head.
Oh, and athletes endorsing prescription medicines and even over-the-counter medicines is a whole other, there's a long history of it. But Willie Mays was really the first endorsement star of color to be featured in the mainstream press. Anybody else? Okay, thank you very much. And thank you for being patient with the lack of